Finn. Finn thinks about the story he tells of the night he and Miranda first danced at a wedding in Cornwall. What does he leave out of the story? The fact that everyone had argued with their partners. Not that anyone knew it at the time. They all thought they were the only ones secretly arguing. David's girlfriend, what's-her-name, wasn't speaking to David. Miranda and her boyfriend, Max, were avoiding each other. Finn's girlfriend, Diana, had thrown a shoe at him the morning of the service and sat in a different pew. What else? He saw Miranda and David on the beach. Finn can't remember if this was the night of the wedding or the night before. He can't remember if it was before or after Miranda danced with Finn. He knows he was drunk. It was late, and Finn was staggering, along the beach. He couldn't see the edge of the water for a long time. His eyes refused to adjust. It was just a black, hissing space in front of him. After a while, he made it out. Darkness rolling in, darkness rolling out. A glass in his hand, a glass on the sand. Oops. He sat down next to it. Two figures were walking along the beach towards him. He could just about make out the pale peach of Miranda's dress. Were they holding hands? He saw it, he was sure, for a moment. Then they saw him and moved apart. Remember the wedding in Cornwall, Finn says to Miranda. I was thinking about it the other day, that all the couples had fallen out. Oh, God. Max proposed, Miranda said. And I said no, and then he told me he hated me. I'd forgotten that. What a mess. And I was almost passed out on the beach. Then you and David found me. David? Miranda looks surprised. No, that was Max. That was after he proposed. He'd stormed off up the beach like he was going to walk to Truro, and I went after him and calmed him down. He said he was sorry, and I said it was okay, but I knew I was going to leave him as soon as the wedding was over. Then we came back and found you sitting in the sand on your own. Really? Finn says. Yes. Why? How can you remember so much detail? I don't even know why Diana threw her shoe at my head. I always thought it was because you'd kissed Carrie, Miranda says. But I think that was unrelated. She had no idea. What? Carrie? Who the... As he says it, Finn remembers Carrie, David's girlfriend. He can't remember what she looked like, though. She reminded him of some actress, and now her face is gone, replaced by the face of the actress she reminded him of, whose name escapes him. I kissed her, he asks. But that's coming back to him now, too. Some of it, anyway. Shit, he says. I'd forgotten. That was later, on the night of the wedding. But how did you know I kissed her? You told me about it a while after we got together. Does David know? No, Miranda says. Of course not. Right, says Finn. Good, I guess. That's good. Are you okay? Miranda asks. You look, I don't know. Frustrated, supplies Finn. Baffled, fearful. Despairing at not knowing if this frustration and bafflement and fear is ever going to end. I'm fine, he says. Why did Finn kiss Carrie? It was in the hotel kitchen. He remembers that now. They'd gone out to find the wedding cake to eat. The lights were off, and there was a buzzing noise from a big industrial fridge. They were drunk, that goes without saying. But there must have been some kind of build-up. probably a mixture of things. Maybe it was because he'd danced with Miranda and felt like he was 100 times the amount of present, 100 times the amount of alive than he'd ever felt in the past. And then Miranda went up to bed with Max. Maybe he thought he deserved it for being noble and forbearing and waiting to dump Diana until they got back home. Maybe it was simple envy of David. Maybe longing for Miranda. Or the way someone else's wedding can stick in the craw. The love and loyalty and love and loyalty everywhere you go. Remorseless. No wonder he made a grab for David's girlfriend in the dark. He kissed Carrie. How could he have forgotten that? But then, those two faces floating along the shoreline in that dim silver light off the sea. One was Miranda. One was David. Finn saw him. Now he sees Max. It's around this time that Finn understands what he's up against. While Miranda might have had part of her memory excised, the rest is so infallible that she still has the advantage over Finn. She's probably already worked out the content of the missing memory just from the shape of it, the exact place where the other memories end. Whereas Finn, at the age of 50, has an old man's memory. The past eludes him, changes shape, combines, divides, moves from one place to another. It's Miranda, it's Carrie, it's Max, it's David. No, it's only Finn, sitting in the sand on his own. It's a door, a window, a wall. Look behind you. No, not there. Now it's behind you. Look. Finn and Miranda have a party. David is invited, of course. It gets to 2 a.m. The good whiskey is out. Someone has just told a story about embarrassing themselves at work. Someone said, "Shame you can't get a memory wipe right now." Then someone else said, "Surely that's over for good. The amount of bad publicity they've had is insane." "It's a good product, though," Finn says. "It's like Viagra. It offers something unique that people can't refuse." In his peripheral vision, Miranda is looking at him. Finn can feel the question coming from her direction. When Miranda is hurt or stressed, her neck flushes. He doesn't look at her or her neck. He lets his gaze swing out wide, moving over the group. "I just don't think it's right," someone says. "Brains are very delicate mechanisms. You start tinkering with them, you break things." Miranda says, "Did anybody see that they shut down the Vine and Escargot in town? I went past it yesterday and saw the sign in the window." "Really?" says someone. Finn talks over them. "I read this article," he says, "that said the brain is capable of much more repair than we give it credit for. So something like nepenthe isn't necessarily dangerous." Agreement. Disagreement. People start talking loudly about memory traces. Finn doesn't really care. He doesn't know if he's right or wrong. He's just waiting for the moment at which someone will inevitably ask one of the doctors present for their opinion. One of the doctors, Miranda, has left the room. But David is still here. And soon enough, someone says, "Come on, David, what's your professional opinion?" Finn looks at David, who, to his disappointment, is leaning back in his chair, smiling. "Nepenthe was never a totally perfect solution," David says. "I heard it wasn't actually that marine snail study that prompted all this restoration furore. They'd already realized that some patients were starting to remember things again after a couple of years or so. It would usually be in dreams or unexplained flashbacks, memory traces. It became apparent that any deletion they did short of burning out the neurons, and maybe not even then, might only ever be temporary. As Finn says, the brain can find surprising ways to repair itself.
That's so sinister, though. The company hiding that, someone says.
Like a film.
How do you know all this? Someone asks David. Do you know someone who works there?
Actually, I do, David says. I live in Crows Hill, where the biggest clinic is. My neighbor works there. And when I was doing my surgical training at St. Helier, I lived with a psych graduate, Louise, who's pretty high up at the company these days. But I didn't hear about it from either of them. My boss knows one of the company heads. They play golf, and they gossip. He shrugs.
Louise, thinks Finn.
Finn knows Louise.
How does he know Louise?
Oh no, I haven't seen her in years, David is saying. Back when I knew her, she was working with the team that would go on to invent Nepenthe. I didn't know that then.
I want to hear about what it's like living next to the Nepenthe clinic, Finn says. It must be like having Huntington Life Sciences in your town.
Or the Scientology headquarters.
It was strange when I went back, David says. It must have been, what, 15, 20 years since I left? Nothing physical about the town had changed. There had been an old glass factory that was demolished and the clinic was built, but that all happened behind a big wall. I've only ever seen pictures of the clinic, but the town felt different.
Interesting, thinks Finn.
You're not missing much, he says. That building is quite a well-known fuck-up, architecturally speaking. Curved glass, burning cars, wind noise, that kind of thing. At this point, the conversation of the group divides. Someone starts talking about frying eggs under the walkie-talkie in London. Other people are making jokes about how Nepenthe doesn't actually zap memories with a laser, it just makes them stand in front of the building on a sunny day. Finn wants to ask David more about Louise. He turns to him. But something about the way David is looking at him makes Finn change his mind. He stands up instead, smiling.
I'll get more drinks, he says.
It turns out that Finn didn't need to ask David after all, because when he's lying in bed later that night, the name arrives, sudden, fully formed, as if dispensed by a machine. Louise Nightingale, saying, "You're very tolerant." Finn looks up Dr. Louise Nightingale. It's not hard. She's the only search result for her own name. There are pages and pages of her, in fact. Louise looks much the same as he remembers. No, she looks better. Her silvery blonde hair is fuller, her teeth whiter, her eyes are a gentle blue. Her mouth has a don't fuck with me shape. Finn only met Louise once, at that university reunion of Miranda's. An unofficial thing in a cocktail bar in Soho. He and Miranda had just moved in together, so it must have been in the late 90s. Nobody knew anything about Nepenthe yet. Louise must have known all about it, this thing that was about to happen to the world, but she said nothing. At that time, Finn knew only that Louise was a psychologist. He'd heard Miranda's reaction when another woman pointed her out.
Great, Miranda said. Now she's weaponized.
Finn had been introduced to Louise early on, then didn't see her again all evening. Not until she slipped into the empty chair next to him and said,
I must say, you're very tolerant.
I'm sorry? What? Said Finn. He didn't get it at first. He was drunk, as usual. But Louise was looking pointedly in one direction, and he eventually came to understand that he ought to look in that direction too. When he did, he saw David and Miranda. They were at the bar, near a speaker, talking closely.
David had stooped down so his mouth was at the level of Miranda's ear. Miranda had tilted the ear up towards him, her head on one side. "How so?" Finn asked Louise. Louise opened her mouth, then she closed it again. "Never mind," she said. "I'm sorry. I spoke out of turn." "I don't understand," Finn said. "What did you mean?" But Louise wouldn't say anything else. She apologized again, though she didn't look particularly sorry, then made her excuses and joined another group of people he didn't know, and even if Finn had known them, he couldn't exactly follow her. And now, it's 20 years later. How? And Finn lives in Arizona, and Louise lives in London, and is a well-known psychologist with whom Finn could have no way of getting in contact, even if he could think of a subtle way of asking her about that night. So he'll never know any more than this. Another get-together, organized by Finn. A small one this time, in the garden. Smoke from the barbecue rushing up to meet a sunset that's as violently beautiful as always. Pink, purple, gold. The red rock behind is lit up like it's on fire. People are laughing. Finn doesn't know why. He'd stopped listening. He laughs along, slightly too late. "We've done a lot of hosting lately," Miranda said to him last night. "We've barely had an evening together. Don't you want a break from it?" "A break?" Finn said incredulously. "From our friends? From fun?" He might have overdone the incredulousness. "Never mind," she said. David is talking to Mbali, making her laugh about something. She's laughing more than she does with Finn. The other day, David had managed, during a 10-minute stroll in the garden, to impress their gardener by knowing the Latin name of some plant. Apparently, it used to be an old remedy for something. Finn knows he shouldn't think, "my," but still, Finn's wife, Finn's friend, Finn's gardener. If Finn owned a dog, David would have bought it biscuits. "Stop," Finn thinks. He's feeling annoyed about a dog he doesn't even own. That's not reasonable. He notices Miranda across the garden, looking at him. She looks worried and wary. Why? He sees himself, standing with people he's not listening to, glaring at nothing. It jolts him. A moment of clarity. Well, he's had a lot of them. After a while, they're easy to ignore. He excuses himself and goes inside to haul another crate of wine out of the larder. They've been getting through more wine these days. Finn himself has accounted for a lot of it. He picks up a couple of bottles and carries them back outside. Unusually, Miranda is up before Finn the next day. She's toasting some bread and has made fresh orange juice. Eggs are cooking in a pan. When Finn comes in, she turns quickly, wearing a nearly convincing smile, and slides a glass of juice across the counter towards him. "Thank you," he says. It comes out very formally. "Need any help?" "All good here," she says. "Almost ready." "Delicious." An awkward silence arrives. Finn strains orange pulp through his teeth, chews it. Miranda stirs the scrambled eggs. Then she turns off the gas. "Finn," she says, "I've been thinking, why don't we go home?"
"Home?"
"Back to England. Or Ireland. Ree keeps saying she wants to go to sixth form in Ireland, and we did always plan to move back, remember?"
"I dimly recall."
"It would be nice to be close to her."
"Ha," says Finn. "Nice for her or for us?"
Miranda acknowledges this with a lift of her spatula, that the two of them are, as always, chasing their daughter. As their daughter moves away from them in her usual way, without a glance back. It's not that Ree isn't loving. It's just that her love has a more than usually independent quality to it. She'll sit curled up with Miranda, sometimes. She'll fall asleep with her head on Finn's shoulder, sometimes. She kisses them goodnight every night, and occasionally at random. Kisses bestowed with the element of surprise, a glancing blow on the side of the face. But if she needs something, she sorts it out herself. If she hurts herself, she doesn't come to them. The only time they can remember it happening was when she fractured her wrist jumping off a swing. "You know, she's going to break someone's heart," Miranda said once. "Yes," said Finn, "ours." Miranda has a fear that Finn's never been able to talk her out of. That the bout of postnatal depression she suffered, her distance at this critical time, was what made Ree so preternaturally self-sufficient. The depression wasn't helped by her anxious online searches, looking up what would happen if Miranda didn't get her shit together, couldn't feel love. "Look, Finn, look at this study. This is what happens to babies that don't get touched enough." Or, "She won't latch because she can tell that there's something wrong with me." And so it was Finn, the not-so-convinced parent, who spent the most time with Ree after she was born, while Miranda saw a therapist who promised to get her back to her usual self, and did, as far as Finn can tell, as far as there is a usual self. And that time. Finn was worried about Miranda, yes, and about Ree, but still, left alone with his daughter. What a mysterious time of wonder that was. Not something that can even be described. Blathering on about tiny fingers clenching one's own, or little feet, or translucent skin, translucent hair, lit up that first summer, falls short of expressing even a fraction of it. Finn can't remember now what he and Miranda were talking about. He smiles at Miranda. If she hadn't been on the other side of the counter dishing up eggs, he'd have reached for her without even thinking about it. She looks surprised, and then she smiles back. Then Finn remembers everything else, the rest of it. Like waking up in another bed and taking a moment to realize where you are. He's not in his own bed anymore. He must have stopped smiling because Miranda's own smile vanishes as quickly as if she's a mime copying his responses. About as funny as that, too. These days she often looks at Finn uncertainly, cautiously, like she's trying to guess what he's thinking. And she guesses his thoughts now, maybe, and looks pained. She talks on, blinking. "Anyway, it doesn't have to be Ireland. I think it could be good for her to have a more international education. Your project's almost finished. There's no need to stay in America. And I'm at a point where I can leave things here. I've been training my own replacement for the last year."
"I don't know," Finn says. He feels suspicious.
He's wanted to move back to Ireland for years, but Miranda found the prospect of continual rain unappealing. He has the sense that he's being distracted. "I thought maybe it would be good to have a change," she continues. "Change always revitalizes us." "On a superficial level," Finn says. Miranda looks stricken. "Okay," she says softly. She comes round to his side of the counter and takes his hand. "Finn, I don't know what to do. You've seemed unhappy lately. I'm worried about you.
Please, talk to me.
He wonders what he might suggest they talk about.
What David meant when he wrote, "The way we were."
What Louise meant when she said, "You're very tolerant." Whether Miranda left Max because she was in love with David, but David was with Carrie, and then by the time David was free, Miranda was with Finn. Until Singapore, when she wasn't. Not all the time.
"You're worried about me," Finn asks. "I'm worried about you, bringing up this idea of moving now. Do you think perhaps you're just doing it because you're worried about Nepenthe? Are you trying to distract yourself from it?"
Unfair, yes. Pompous, undoubtedly. And the tone was all wrong. It was supposed to sound concerned, but instead it sounded angry. No wonder, really, that Miranda dropped his hand and went over to the sink. She turned on the tap. Then she turned it off and leaned on the countertop, not looking at him.
I honestly...
"Look, what is happening? Something's wrong, I know it. You aren't telling me everything." He doesn't mean to say it, but he does.
"I could say the same about you."
"What is it, Finn?" she says. She doesn't sound tired anymore. She sounds desperate.
"What do you mean? I'd tell you anything. What do you think I haven't told you? Whatever it is, ask me. I'll tell you. Please."
But he can't answer.
"Please,"
she says again. But he can't ask. Later, after a while of not talking, Miranda went to town. She had her bag in her hand when she told him, pausing briefly in the doorway. She didn't say what she'd be doing in town or when she'd be back. Finn remembers standing outside Winchester Palace, looking up at the sky through the empty rose window, Miranda looking at him with that closeness, that interest. He felt the look running all through him like lightning. What happened next? David arrived. Finn wants to go back to that exact moment, the two of them standing alone, the others disappeared around one corner, David not yet visible beyond the other. It's Finn's story. It's fake, maybe, but at least partly true, and Finn was happy there. For over 20 years, Finn's been standing in that moment, he and Miranda outside Winchester Palace, with nobody else in sight. But now, David has come around the corner to join them.
"It's my story," Finn wants to say to David. "I tell it, not you. Give it back."
That night, Finn goes into the bathroom. He thought Miranda was in bed, but he finds her sitting on the edge of the bath, crying. She jumps when he comes in.
"Miranda, what's wrong?"
"Oh, just," she says.
"Don't say nothing," Finn thinks, at the same time as he thinks, "Please, please say nothing." She says nothing. She takes some tissues and wipes her eyes. Finn stands in the doorway, not knowing what to do. Eventually, Miranda blows her nose, looks up, and says,
"I called the clinic. I'm going to get the memory back. I've got an appointment in early November. I booked a flight."
"Really?"
Finn's taken aback.
"But I thought you didn't want to. What made you decide to do it?"
"It's like you said," she says. "It's been on my mind. I'm not happy either. Life won't go back to normal until I do it." Finn stares at her, dismayed. He understands, suddenly, that this isn't going to be how he finds out the truth,
Of course it isn't. Not if she doesn't want him to. It's why he hasn't asked her if anything happened with David. She wouldn't tell him. And now, Miranda could fly to England, spend a day sightseeing, come back, tell him she got the memory back, some patient dying in horrific circumstances or whatever, and that will be that. Even if Finn went to Crow's Hill with her and sat in the Nepenthe waiting room, she could still come out and tell a lie. Really, Finn? Go his thoughts. Has it come to this? And he is ashamed. Ashamed and still suspicious. The two things coexisting. Self-hatred. Fear. Thinking at the same time, I love my daughter, but with something else running underneath that. A stream of thought that goes, my or his? Miranda called her Rionic. She looked it up in a book. I said I'd never heard of it. It was totally archaic, but pretty, absolutely. And Miranda was determined to give her an Irish name. Why? Calling the cuckoo in the nest? Oh, cuckoo? I love my daughter. Or I love his daughter. Which is it? Does it matter if she isn't my daughter? Does it matter if Miranda was his lover before she was mine? His after she was mine? Mine. His. And it doesn't stop. When did Finn become so obsessed with what's his? It's primitive. It's everything he hates. But knowing something is stupid and deplorable doesn't make it go away. He hears it at night, the thought, starting back up again, his, mine, his or mine. Finn wonders if he's always been this person, somewhere, a paranoid, tense, manipulative person, or if he's just responding to circumstance. He remembers the conversation in which Miranda rejected the concept of self. That party was 3 weeks ago. It feels like a lot longer than that. He can't even remember what she said. It might even have been helpful, but he can't exactly ask her about it now. When Finn's company won the contract for the neighbourhood project, Finn gave a talk to the staff about what he wanted to do. As Finn had said to David, he tended to resort to bullshit when he talked about architecture, telling people that design and history were in conversation. That his own role was merely, humbly, to facilitate this conversation. But the thing was, this spiel wasn't complete bullshit. Though he may not be able to translate the conversation, Finn can still sense it taking place. It's an interplay, an energy flow. When there's a true sympathy between the old and new, Finn can feel it. He tried to explain this to his team, some of whom lived in the neighbourhood they'd be redeveloping. He said that the new draws its strength from the old without crushing it or ignoring it. The old, anything lost or unwanted or fragmentary, is to be protected, restored, gathered up into the arms of the present to live again. Continuity of story, he said. Whatever was there before can't be ignored. We can't just tell a new story. We have to find a way to include the old story too. When he thinks of that speech now, it makes him angry. Maybe the best thing to do would be for Finn himself to get a memory wipe. Forget the day he saw the email from Nepenthe, the last few weeks. What was it Othello said when he found Desdemona's handkerchief in Cassio's possession? By heaven, I would most gladly have forgot it. Thou saidst, oh, it comes o'er my memory, as doth the raven o'er the infectious house, boding to all. He had my handkerchief. But Finn has to know. That's the problem. Is he right or wrong? He doesn't know what happens if he's right.
He can't be right.
A week passes and they hear nothing from David.
Where are you?
Wonders Finn. It's only another few days now until David flies home. A great stone is rolling into place, and if Finn doesn't run towards it, throw himself through the closing gap, he'll be trapped underground forever. Finn starts an email to David. Hi, David. Hello, David. Dear David. He abandons it. He can't get the tone right.
Affable Finn, the old charmer, is too far out of reach. So he waits. It's Miranda who brings him the news that David had to leave early. Some patient of his back in London suffered complications of some sort, and David decided to fly back immediately to check on her, missing his last weekend in Phoenix, his own goodbye drinks. He's already gone. So that's it. The end came and went without Finn even knowing. He said he had a great time and was very grateful for our hospitality. He's sorry not to say goodbye in person, but wishes you all the best, Miranda says, reading out David's text. All the best, Finn wants to demand. That's it. All the best. He wants to sit down heavily, like someone who's had a shock. He has had a shock, but not one that can be shown or soothed. He can only shake his head and murmur something about it being a shame, and he'll drop David a line to say he was very welcome. All the rest of the day, Finn feels not much. He doesn't feel relieved. He doesn't feel disappointed or angry. He feels only absence, a perfect, empty flatness. All his energy up until today has been directed at David or what David represents, and now he can't remember what his life was before David arrived. This is what purgatory must be like, he thinks. Heaven is knowledge of goodness. Hell is knowledge of evil. Purgatory is not knowing which is which. In one possible story, David is a decent man who probably fancied Miranda once, maybe even kissed her, or slept with her. Then, when Finn came along, decently stepped aside, went to Canada, got married, kept a safe distance. It's just Finn isn't sure if this is the story he's living in. When he thinks of Miranda these days, he sees different women, from different possible stories, inhabiting the same space. The starry, crucial Miranda of the wedding in Cornwall. A smiling Miranda among the sweet peas outside their first house in London. A hopeful Miranda on the step in Singapore in the rain. Miranda looking at him outside Winchester Palace. Miranda saying something in David's ear in a bar. The way we were. Miranda arriving home, resting her head on Finn's shoulder. Miranda sitting on the edge of the bath, crying. When he thinks of Ree, he thinks, no, he can't think about Ree. Miranda is working at the table, facing away from Finn. She's pulled her ponytail over one shoulder and is twisting it with one hand, concentrating. A familiar gesture. The pale back of her neck is visible, the fabric of her shirt pulled across her shoulder blades. Is she thinner? Her shoulders are tight. Tenderness and sorrow come over him, pass away. It's a strange feeling not knowing who you live with. In what story? It puts him on the outside of things. He's watching a film. He can feel the ending on the horizon. Fin. The problem is, he suspects it's going to be one of those arty, ambiguous endings he pretends to appreciate while secretly preferring endings with answers. Rosebud. Kaiser Soze, Norman Bates' mother. But then, he's chased an answer without really considering what it would be like to get one, without really believing in any of the things it might be. It's all so extreme, that's the problem. Betrayal or safety, despair or happiness, war or peace. But if he gives up the chase, what happens then? The in-between, the nothing, the numbness. This. Forever. Finn and Miranda have been avoiding each other. Neither of them says this is what they're doing. They just do it. On Sunday morning, Miranda gets up and goes to the grocery store before Finn wakes up. Then she says she's got a headache and is going to have a nap in the garden. She opens up a sun lounger and lies on it, fully clothed. She's wearing sunglasses, so he can't tell if she's asleep or not. Finn works in his study for a while, then, stifled by his own company, makes up an excuse to go out. He writes Miranda a note, "I didn't want to disturb your sleep," and puts it on the worktop. He drives to Tucson, where fewer people know him, and sits in a bar with a beer. His sense of being behind a glass wall has not faded. He isn't enjoying the beer. But he knows if he says to the barman, "This beer has no taste," the barman will say something along the lines of, "No, sir, I'm afraid it's you that's the problem. What did you expect? You're not in the story. You're looking at the world through glass. On your side of the glass, you're in darkness. But if you like, I can get you another beer." Finn doesn't want to have that conversation, even by implication. So he pays and drives back to the house, where he finds Ree.
Ree?
Ree. Finn is so stunned that he comes to a halt in the doorway. If he had been carrying anything, he'd have dropped it, rubbed his eyes, mouth agape. But here she is, standing in the kitchen, an inch taller, or just his imagination, facing away from him and fiddling with the coffee machine. Then she turns round and laughs.
"Hi, Dad," she says. "Surprise!"
Ree. She has a few more freckles. Her fringe has overleaped her eyebrows to brush her lashes. She really does seem, she can't be, taller. There's a light coming out of her, not soft or luminous, but active and rippling, like the light that comes off the North Atlantic, off Dunqueen. It moves when she moves, turns when she turns. She raises one eyebrow.
"Look," she says, "I drink coffee now, and I can raise one eyebrow."
Then she bounds over and wraps her arms around him in her enthusiasm, bellowing, "I missed you," accidentally straight into his ear. Finn welcomes the volume. He wants the sound to hit him, knock him over, roar through him. He wants obliteration. He's trying not to cry into her hair.
"So, what did you do without me?" she asks.
Over his shoulder, he hears a giggle, a sniff, a wipe of her nose, possibly on his pullover.
"Was it awful?"
He finds his voice.
"It was worse than you can even imagine."
She giggles again and disengages, rubbing her face, slightly embarrassed, as she always is, by emotion.
"Oh, good.
But I thought you were back on
Tuesday, yeah. But our teacher, Miss Hobart, got caught buying cocaine in Berlin and got the sack on the spot. And then we didn't have the legal number of teachers to keep an eye on us, which is funny, really, because, you know, turned out it was more like they needed us to keep an eye on them. And anyway, there'll probably be a massive fuss about it. You and Mom will laugh your heads off."
Tuesday. He'd even forgotten she was coming back this Tuesday.
I'm sorry, he mumbles.
Why do you look so horrified? I don't care. I hated Miss Hobart. And now you can be like, I told you so, to Mom, because it proves your point about modern schooling or whatever. Anyway, I did call to tell you, but your mobile was off and Mom's rang out. Then I thought it would be funny to surprise you. I got a lift back with Nandy and her dad. Anyway, then I got home and you were out and Mom's fast asleep, so it's not actually as dramatic as I was hoping. But, she laughs, you still look pretty surprised, Dad.
Finn looks out of the window. Miranda is still on the lounger, one arm thrown over her face, like she's warding off some nightmare. Dreaming of Finn, maybe. Forgive me, he thinks.
Well, we'll have to get your welcome party started, he says. I'll cook something nice. Oh yeah, I'm a vegetarian now. Is that a problem?
That's fine. Is there anything else I should know? Besides the vegetarianism and the eyebrow and the coffee?
Nope, that's it. Obviously, I'm more cultured and cosmopolitan from all the traveling, but you probably noticed that already.
It was the first thing I noticed. Shall we make some coffee then? We'll take an espresso to your mother.
Cappuccino for me.
Oh?
With lots of milk. Lots of foam, lots of chocolate dust.
Percentage of actual coffee?
About 30.
Darling girl, says Finn. She cringes, physically, away from the sentiment.
Roots in a cupboard for the cocoa. Says, over her shoulder,
you know, the tour missed off Dublin? We didn't visit Ireland at all. Can we go there? It's actually stupid that I haven't been, what with being named after an ancient queen and everything.
Sure, he says. We can go to Ireland.
Miranda, sleeping outside in the sun. Ree, here in the kitchen. It doesn't matter, Finn thinks, what story he's in. Ree is looking at him in horror.
Dad, you're crying.
My apologies, says Finn. If I'd known you were coming home, I'd have done it beforehand, like a respectable father. I'm just, well, I'm sorry.
But the tears won't stop. He reminds himself, finally, not of Othello, but of King Lear. I am a very foolish, fond old man. And Ree, tutting, still looking faintly scandalized, doesn't sidle away. She leans against him and strokes his arm. She smells different. Some intense vanilla and parma violet combination. A pop star perfume bought at the airport, no doubt. Lovely only to young girls. For no reason, this makes him cry more.
Oh dear, Dad, she says. You've got to get it together.
I know, Finn answers in his head, where his voice can't give way. I will.